This is part one of the interview with Andrew Romay from February 18th, 2014.
I was born in 1922, mm-hmm. and that means that...
And what you were born as, what was your name when you were born?
The city?
Your name when you were born was...
Was Friedman.
Friedman,
yes. My family name was Friedman.
Mm-hmm.
Friedman, which means that the man of peace. Man of peace. Hozzá kell, hogy tegyem, hogy az apám soha nem változtatta meg a nevét. És én voltam az egyetlen, mert én voltam a családban az egyetlen, akik deportáltak. Szóval a családom többi része szerencsésebben megmenekült ebből a borzalomból, mint én, és ők nem mentek keresztül azon, mint én, bár nem mondom, hogy egy jó dolguk volt, de tény az, hogy ők nem változtatták meg. De visszatérve, egy vidéki városban éltünk, Miskolcon, shall we say it in English?
Maybe you could talk first about your, like, how far back do you know what your family was doing and where it lived?
Okay. My father was involved in essentially in trade. His business consisted of buying up the product of farmers,
mm-hmm.
in the whole area.
Mm-hmm.
He financed them, and then ultimately they sold their product, wheat and similar stuff,
mm-hmm.
To my father, and he in turn sold it to various customers.
So this was in Miskolc?
Essentially a wholesale, mm-hmm. wholesale merchant.
Mm-hmm. In cereals and grains?
Yes, things like that, yes. That's in large quantities, that is in the tons and sometimes even a truckload and even more than that.
Okay.
So that was his business.
And his name was Friedman. What was his name?
His name was Friedman.
His first name?
Oh, Eugene.
Eugene.
Eugene. Eugene Friedman.
Mm-hmm.
Eugene Friedman was his name.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a very successful businessman. And consequently, I had an easy and pleasant childhood.
Mm-hmm.
Even though, of course, living in Hungary meant certain restrictions imposed on Jews, but as a young man, I didn't feel it. I mean, I knew that there were restrictions, I knew that there were discrimination against Jews, but they were tolerable.
Mm-hmm.
They were tolerable, and particularly since we were a well-to-do, I might say, a well-to-do family, We didn't feel the burdens to be so bad.
So what about your mother?
My mother was a typical mother who devoted all her life to bring up the children.
What was her maiden name? What was her full maiden name?
Her maiden name was Margaret Simon. Simon.
Mm-hmm. Was she also from Miskolc area?
Yes, she was from Miskolc. That's right. And her parents were quite prominent in the Jewish community. Her parents.
Mm-hmm. How did your parents meet?
I'm sorry.
How did your parents meet?
I don't know the answer to that. I really don't know.
Did either of them? Did either of them speak languages besides Hungarian?
No, No, they're only Hungarian. Mm-hmm. Only Hungarian. Although in Hungary in those days, German was the second language, and my father spoke reasonable German, mm-hmm. but at home, only Hungarian. Mm-hmm. And they spoke German only when it was necessary. It was not done.
So were they religious?
No, my father was quite religious, and therefore we had a kosher, you know what that is?
Yeah.
A kosher household. Mm-hmm. We had a kosher household because my father insisted that we should have it kosher, mm-hmm. because his family was more Orthodox than on my mother's side. Mm-hmm. So, yes, we did have a kosher household. And we went to the synagogue on Saturdays, and I had my... When you reach 13 years old, you become a man. Mm-hmm. So it's called a bar mitzvah. Mm-hmm. And that was a big celebration mm-hmm. when I became 13 years old.
How big was the... what was the Jewish community like in Miskolc? Was it... were there more Orthodox or...
Okay. I'm not sure if I'm giving you the correct answer. I think it was more secular, more assimilated than Orthodox. Mm-hmm. But not to the extent as it later became. I would say it's a mixed situation. You had in that relatively small town, although in terms of Hungary it was not that small. I think it was the third or fourth largest city mm-hmm. in the country. It's about 80,000 people, but there was a fairly sizable Jewish community, and they had as much as I can remember my childhood, that in spite of the fact that there was restrictions called the numerus clausus, that means a number up to which Jews were accepted and beyond which they were rejected. So that means that, for instance, in that gymnasium, in this one here, very few Jewish, it was boys only, boys were accepted. In a class of about 60, between 50 to 60, we had about four or five Jewish boys. So there were definitely restrictions.
Did everybody know who was what?
Yes, everyone knew who were the Jews, who were not the Jews. Yes.
Did you form friendships across that?
Yes, we were getting there were a few anti-Semites, and we knew them, and we obviously we didn't make friends with them. But I would say the average was, although everyone knew who is Jew, who is not Jew, but they went along reasonably well. Now, that was major calamity of any sort. No.
Did you, at the time when you were growing up, did you see yourself as Hungarian?
Yes, absolutely. Essentially, all the Jews, even Orthodox Jews, consider themselves Hungarians. Overwhelmingly, almost without exception. they only spoke Hungarian, they only learned Hungarian, they considered the Jewishness as a sort of a religion, religious affiliation, that we are Jewish Hungarians and this guy is Roman Catholic Hungarian and he is Protestant, etc., etc. But the Jewish identity was considered a religious affiliation, not national.
So how long had your family been in Miskolc? Did like how many generations, or did they come from some other place to Miskolc?
On my mother's side, I can only trace them two generations. Actually, on my father's side, even less. But on my father's side, most of the family was out of Miskolc. Cities in Hungary.
Did you know your grandparents?
Yes, yes. I visited my grandfather, who is still alive. Visited my grandfather at least once a year in a town called Chateau, which was about an hour train ride from.
And what was his name? Was he on your father?
Also Friedman.
Okay, so he was your father's father.
Yes.
Okay. And what was he, what did he do?
He was had a very modest living. Coal and wood for firewood, mm-hmm. firewood and fire coal, mm-hmm. but on a very small scale. Mm-hmm. So we had to sort of occasionally help them out. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but they were more hard.
Did they speak any Yiddish or only Hungarian also?
Only Hungarian. Now, my grandfather may have spoken Jewish Yiddish, mm-hmm. Yiddish, but it was not customary, not within the family, maybe with others, mm-hmm. but not with the family, because we wouldn't understand it. Mm-hmm. I would not understand, and to this day I don't understand mm-hmm. Yiddish. Except maybe a few words, yes, but mm-hmm. if someone starts talking Yiddish, I cannot follow it. Mm-hmm.
Can you describe for me what your family home was like?
In Miskolc?
Yeah.
We were, as I said before, we were quite well-to-do. Mm-hmm. And my parents owned that building where we lived. Mm-hmm. It was a one-story high building. A nice area, and we had a fairly large apartment. I would say more or less the size of this apartment. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but again, my father owned the building, so he rented out the rest of it.
And what was the address in Miskolc?
What does it mean to you? Number Semere Utsa 3. Semere is a fairly well-known minister of justice in those days. And the street was named after him, number 3.
Mm-hmm. Is it still called Semere Utsa? Maybe.
I'm not sure, but I wouldn't be surprised. I would. Since that guy was not involved in politics, my guess is that yes, the answer is probably yes.
Okay. So tell us maybe a bit about what it was like growing up. And did you have brothers and sisters?
No, I had a brother, I had a brother. We didn't get along very well. The two boys, we were very different in character and nature. And my brother I was always an eminent student myself. He was not. So he had, my parents had to take him in and out from various schools. At one point, he was sent to Debrecen, mm-hmm. where there was a Jewish high school. Mm-hmm. The high school is called Gymnasium. Mm-hmm. The high school, and my brother, I think, was there for about 2 years before he came back to Miskolc, to the same gymnasium as where I was. Now, after the maturity, at the age of 18, you have this maturity examination. Mm-hmm. At the age of he went to Paris, and he was accepted in the Sorbonne in Paris. So he spent there a year, but to his misfortune, he came back just before the war broke out, maybe a month or so before, and got stuck in Hungary. He couldn't go back. I was younger, so I was home anyway. So I had no chance to go anywhere, because we are now in 1939 and 40. I had this maturity examination in 1940, and the war started in 39 by the Russians, by the Germans, the Nazis invading Poland. Mm-hmm. Poland in September 1st of 1939. Mm-hmm. And then the whole world changed upside down, I could say. Definitely down, not up.
Did it change then or later?
Well, it started. The whole thing, looking back at it, it's clear that it started at that point. I mean, the war was overhanging for quite some time, even before. Mm. But there were all kinds of hopes that somehow some kind of a compromise would be worked out between the West and the Germans. But of course, it was a joke. Hitler was not interested in any peaceful agreement. He wanted to take it all.
So did you have political discussions at home with your parents?
Political? Yeah. Oh, every day.
So what were their political positions?
Well, all Jews were rooting, obviously, for England and France.
And but I mean, let's say in the interwar period, before, let's say...
Before. Mm-hmm. Well, Hitler got to power in 1933. Yeah, 33. And from then on, things got worse and worse. Of course, in the first few years, only for the German Jews. And we, the Hungarian Jews, said, all right, those are the German Jews. But it cannot happen to us. We are Hungarians. We are Hungarians, so it's not the same thing, etc. That sort of an attitude. So, obviously, every day, I would say every hour, we were rooting, obviously, for some sort of a compromise worked out by the West and somehow stopped Hitler.
What about domestic politics in Hungary? What did your parents think of Horthy or of, you know?
We all knew, of course, that the Hungarian management, the regent Horthy and his administration was very much to the right. That means that they were close to the German ideas. They thought that Hungary's future lies in the victory of the Germans. The Germans, particularly Hitler, promised the Hungarians that most of a great deal of the territories that the Hungarians lost in the First World War will be given back to Hungary if the Germans win. So Hungary became more and more involved in the German war effort.
So your parents lived through World War One. How did they experience World War One?
Well, I don't know the answer to that, except that it was my impression that they, first of all, under the Habsburg rules, the Jews were living reasonably well, mm-hmm. and there was nothing even closely similar to what happened in the Second World War. So in other words, the First World War was almost like a child's game compared to the Second.
What about, how did they experience the, like, Trianon or Hungary becoming much smaller? Did they ever talk about that? Did they experience it themselves somehow?
I mean, that Hungary lost all those territories?
Yeah.
It was not particularly a subject of discussion within the family, mm-hmm. because by the time we grew up, that was sort of a given fact. And of course, we all knew that this is a big pain, and the Hungarians got hurt badly, and in the school and in papers, in publicity, they always kept reminding us that there was this tremendous injustice that was imposed on Hungarians. So we all knew that, but we were not. We were not directly affected, mm-hmm. by that, mm-hmm. except of course that some of our relatives, uncles and cousins, they became Romanian citizens in Transylvania.
Oh, so they lived in Transylvania.
Yeah, in Nagyvárad, etc. So that was.
Did your family maintain a connection with them?
Yes, but not on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. On and off, yes. Mm-hmm. Of course, what happened, as you probably know, some of those territories were indeed given back to Hungary by Hitler when he started the war, mm-hmm. so that to entice the Hungarians to become an active ally, and most unfortunately,
including
my uncle and his wife and the beautiful child, I don't know, somewhere up here. They were all of them, they were sort of became Hungarian citizens for a relatively short period during the beginning of the war, like about
1940.
maybe three or four years. And and that meant that they were killed. That since it was part of Hungary, and since when the Germans started the deportation, they started out in the
provinces,
right? So they were unfortunately deported and killed. Yeah. But that was somewhat later. So,
what do you remember about the conversations that took place at home? Did your parents ever talk about leaving, or?
I'm sorry.
What do you remember from the conversations that you had at home with your parents? Did your parents have different political views, or did you and your brother, or were
there? No. How could they? Because we were all affected. It's a Jewish family, so our expectations, our hopes, they're all the same.
Was the idea that you would stay? Or was there ever any talk of leaving?
Yes. Unfortunately, as I said before, Hungarians took it for granted, Hungarian Jews, mm-hmm. took it for granted that nothing like what happened in Germany and to the German Jews would happen to us, because we are really Hungarians. Right? So they didn't try to escape. It was just hoping that things will turn out better. It was a horrible mistake looking back at it, but nothing of the sort was done. And of course, at the time when the war started in 1939, then it became hopeless. Because Hungary was surrounded by the Germans or the German allies, because all these neighboring countries, in the beginning of the war, they became one way or another allied to Hitler, whether it's Romania or Czechoslovakia or Yugoslavia. Not with such an enthusiasm as the Hungarians, certainly not, and particularly not the Yugoslavia, Slovenes or
Serbs,
but
Slavs,
yeah, but anyway, the gates were closed. There was no way to get out anymore.
So did the atmosphere change in Hungary itself, let's say, after 1939 or after 1940? Was there a difference in, let's say... So when did you graduate from high school?
In 1940.
Oh, so right when the...
A year after the war started.
And so, were you conscripted into labor service?
No, at that point, it was still relatively. All the restrictions, of course, were in effect in Hungary, but nothing comparable to what Hitler imposed on the German Jews and wherever his soldiers went. So it was still bad and got gradually worse, but it was still tolerable. Mm-hmm. The atmosphere was horrible, but nothing really tragic that ultimately did hit Hungary in 44 and 45 happened. So that means that after I passed my maturity thing, mm-hmm. I was actually accepted at the University of Economics in Budapest.
Oh.
And at that point, all my family moved from Miskolc to Budapest.
Why?
That's in 1940.
Why? Why did the whole family go?
Because all they felt that life is safer within a big Jewish community like we had in Budapest.
Well, they were right, I guess.
And for some personal reasons as well. So they hardly waited for me to pass the maturity. And a month later, when I was admitted to the university, the whole family moved. And that thing, that move, really, really saved the life of our family, because needless to say that Jews in the countryside were all killed, but that comes later. But by the time they were about to start to do the same thing to the Budapest Jews, it was too late for the Germans, because the war already turned around. Mm-hmm. And by then they were retreating all over. They were a general retreat, and it now appeared that the war will be lost. So at that point, the regent intervened and stopped all the deportation.
But let's go back to this period, 40 yeah. to 44. So then you were in the economics university. What was it like studying economics at that time? I mean, it must have been quite...
Well, just like... you know, once you are a student, there is no you have really no problem. I mean, whether you are a Jew or not a Jew, it didn't make much difference.
What kind of economics were you studying at the university?
Well, that's the classical Western plutocratic. The same. Same ideas that lead this country or any Western countries. They were the subject of our studies in that university.
So who were you reading then, like Adam Smith or?
Yes, the classic thing, classic. Classic stuff.
Did you read any Keynes, or was that too...
Who?
Keynes, John Maynard Keynes.
Keynes? I really don't know the answer. I can't remember. But all the classics were subject of our studies. And for us, communism was rejected out of hand.
Okay, so you didn't even read Marx?
Nothing.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. That was entirely...
taboo.
That's a... No, that was... Don't touch it.
Was there anyone at the university who was touching it at the time?
Not really. No. No,
like not among the students.
But you see, all the professors, they come from the old generation.
Well, what about the students? I mean, as they see what's
the
going
students,
on.
Well, the students followed essentially. For us, the idea of communism was an entirely out of the question entirely. So that was not done. Of course, later on, I had a little problem with that, but that comes much later. So it was a classical studying of economics in the university. Right?
And was there an ideological take that was presented to you about the economics of the war, about the relationship with Germany? Did they say anything about
that? No, that they were. Of course, I cannot speak for all the professors because there were quite a few that I haven't studied with. But those who I did, they did not, no, certainly not. And they did everything to preserve the academic standard, the level, and try to keep politics out of it. Mm-hmm. Except, of course, as I said before, the idea of Marx and Lenin,
right.
No.
So why did you decide to study economics?
Why?
Yeah.
That's an excellent question. The French says, faute de mieux, that means in the lack of something else. because I always wanted to be a doctor. Mm. I wanted to go to medicine, but that exactly was the most difficult to get into medical school in Hungary for a Jewish boy. Mm. So I was not accepted in the medical school. So I had to be happy to be admitted anywhere. Mm. And that was our salvation, really.
Mm-hmm. And who were your kind of cultural heroes when you were growing up? Did you have any, like people that you read or that you looked up to?
Our cultural hero?
Yeah.
In those days, everything was politicized extremely. So they were following what the leader of this country said and the leader of the country. So we had to... They followed the war on a daily basis. I was able to tell you where the Germans are exactly. If it's Dniepropetrovsk in Russia, I knew exactly where they are and what is next, which way they are going to turn, and if they had a setback. I had a good day. And of course, needless to say that there was no TV in those days.
Did you have BBC
no
radio?
No TV, but our only source of information was the BBC. Mm-hmm. So, under drawn curtains, because that was forbidden, needless to say, we watched every evening the BBC, including the Hungarian, they also had a Hungarian broadcast. So
what about
so
in the
I idolized obviously Churchill in those days, and very much. Upset how the French behaved, all kinds of that.
What about in the interwar period? Were there people that you read that, you know, did you like to read novels or did you have kind of
what I read in those days, I don't know, the classics were available, but I read it, I cannot recall what I...
Or people like Claudine T,
so involved in it by studies, the economics, and the politics, and the because our very life was at stake. So it's it took all our attention.
So who were your friends at that time?
Friends?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, friends. I had a number of friends from the high school, mm-hmm. and made a few at the college, at the university. And not too many, because in those days you had to watch every word you say. And you didn't have full trust in just like in everybody. We had to be extremely careful what you say and any conversation sooner rather than later drifted always to what's going to happen to us. Because we knew that the outcome of the war is the outcome of our life.
So did you have friends who were non-Jews at the time, ones from Mishkotel?
Very few.
Mm-hmm. Did you get a sense from them what they were thinking?
Well, those who were fairly close, yes, he seemed to go along and think along the same lines as we did. But somehow that sort of a closeness was still missing.
This was a friend from Mishkolts, or
no, not necessarily. Yeah, some of them. Yes, others up in Budapest. Mm-hmm. So those were very, very, very tough times because anyone whom you would believe is your friend may turn against you in some ways, and therefore, and knowing all that, you had to be very careful in everything what you say. So, I don't think that there was a true friendship between Jewish and non-Jewish people. There was some, you know, I'm not saying that they didn't talk to each other, they did. But,
was this true before the war or just during the war?
That was, to some extent, it existed even before the war, mm-hmm. but not to the same extent as the war progressed. Now, became more and more like a wall separating you from the other guy.
Did that wall remain after the war?
You see, so by the time the war ended, and by the time I came back from the from this death camp, so many things have changed that I cannot recall having been able to talk to the same people as I did to a year or two before. The whole world changed entirely. So
maybe you should talk about what happened to you during the war and to your family. We can talk about that.
Well, that's you know. From 1939 to 1944, the Jews were living in panic, but not in mortal danger. I mean, not an immediate danger. Except those young men who were called in by the military and sent out to the front, in Russia. Because by then the Hungarians were fighting on the side of Germany.
Right.
And then many of those guys were sent out to do the labor work.
Labor service.
The labor. So for them it was bad, it was horrible. But for me, I was lucky because as a university student, I got what was called a deferment. Mm-hmm. Year after year, I got a deferment. I didn't have to go. And all my contemporaries did have to go, and quite many of them perished. I was saved by the fact that I was a student. So I got legal deferments every year till 1944.
Had you finished the university by then? Or?
No, I couldn't finish the university because just a few months before the end of the last semester, the Germans invaded Hungary in March of 1944. And then I was thrown out from the university. I couldn't go back again. And then I was called in and became also a member of the enforced labor camp within Hungary.
How long did that
under
take?
Hungarian management.
So how long did that take, you know, with from the, I assume you're talking about March 15th, so...
How long it did
for you to...
Almost nothing, like 2 months or something.
So by 2 months later?
Yeah, by May or so, I was already in that forced labor camp,
And where were you?
That was in the countryside, but within Hungary.
Mm-hmm.
They did all kinds of things. All kinds of things. So, and at that point, as I told you,
what about your brother?
In the meantime, all the Jews from the countryside were deported, and of course we didn't exactly know what happened to them, but there were all kinds of rumors that they are being killed somewhere in Poland or so, because the Auschwitz and the Birkenau and these other camps were not known. Everything was, the Germans did it in secret. They said, okay, we'll go out and you just do a little labor here and there. But in the meantime, they took the little children and the women, everyone. So, at any rate, my family lived in Budapest, in the same apartment, and when I went in the forced labor camp, they were still there. But in a month or two later, they had to be forcefully removed to the ghetto, which means that within the ghetto, the buildings were marked with a huge yellow star, and that were sort of segregated from the rest.
So this is where you were stationed?
No, my parents were. I was in the labor camp.
So where was the labor camp?
Labor camp was maybe about 50 or 60 miles from Budapest. Mm-hmm.
Which town was it in?
Which town? Good question. You know what? I should have. I can't tell you exactly. It was a very small place. I know which direction it's going to the east.
Oh.
I'm sorry. It will come back to me.
Okay.
I don't know. It was a small village or so. But later on, even the forced labor camp was moved back to Budapest.
Oh.
So, in the summer of 1944, I was within that camp in Budapest, and my parents were in the ghetto, also in Budapest.
Mm-hmm. What was it like in the camp, the labor camp? I mean, what kinds of stuff were you doing?
Other than being discriminated as Jews, and being said these dirty Jews and this Jews and that Jew, and all kinds of little humiliations, it was tolerable. I mean, you know, we worked and we had a decent building where we slept, sometimes in a church or wherever, or a synagogue, I don't know. And the food was also decent food, to the point that then after all I was deported to Germany. At night, it came back to me that wonderful food that we had in the forced labor camp. Yeah. Now, in other words, it was somewhat humiliating. It was quite humiliating. But I cannot say that it was entirely inhuman as the experience in the death camp in Germany. It was still considerably better.
And what were the camp commanders like? These were Hungarian officers,
yes.
Hungarian military?
And, you know, they're all kinds. Some of them were horrible guys and made life miserable. But others, they were quite decent fellows who understood the situation. And of course, they couldn't do too much because they themselves were under big pressure. But, for instance, our commander was quite a nice fellow, quite a decent fellow.
Where was he from? What was his story?
He, what was his business? I think he owned a shop where they sold beer and wine and that sort of thing. But not so. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let me tell you an interesting that you might be interested to hear. One day when we worked all day, of course, after work, when we went back to where we were put up, the man, this commander, called in all the people and said, "Man, I have excellent news for you." "What is that?" I talked to the chaplain of the, priest, of this and this little church in Budapest, and he agreed, that after you are all baptized, all of you, you are going to get a letter of protection. I have to come back to that. Letter of protection from the Pope. Now, in those days, when the war was already coming to an end, the Germans were in retreat everywhere, and some of the representatives of Switzerland and Sweden, and ultimately the Pope, they started to issue letters of protection, which said that this and this guy is under the protection of the Switzerland, Sweden, Pope, whatever. Now, you might say that the whole thing is ridiculous because all these so-called powers really had no power at all in Budapest. I mean, the Swiss consul or the Swedish consul or even the Pope. But interestingly, the whole irrational atmosphere was such that such letters of protection were accepted, were tolerated, and those who had it were able, at least temporarily, to get away with it. So that priest promised to give us the letter of protection of the Pope, but in exchange, or in return, wanted all of us to baptize. So, and I felt utterly that this is something I just cannot go along with. Out of the almost 200 people, 200 forced laborers, with the exception of maybe 10 or 15 very Orthodox Jews. All of them were out of their mind with joy, and they said, "And that's wonderful, this and this," and they all got prepared to go to the chapel. They got baptized, and I said sided with the I was certainly not an Orthodox Jew, mm-hmm. but I sided with the Orthodox, and I said I am not going. I said that the Pope and I went for 8 years to a school that was taught by Roman Catholic priests. Mm-hmm. They all said that their religion is protecting the weak, those who need protection, and they don't ask anything in exchange. And certainly not something that you give up your religion. That was not done since the Spanish, famous Spanish thing in the Middle Ages, when Isabella la Católica insisted that all the Spanish Jews
convert,
baptize, and those who were not, they were thrown out. So I said, this at this price, to baptize, to give up, to give up the way I was brought up, and particularly to pay such a ransom, which I considered it a ransom, mm-hmm, I would not do it. So I went back to the barracks and I said, that's it. So all of the others, with a few exceptions, went, and that was it. I went to sleep, and I had a very, very sweet blue-collar friend of mine, who said I was an idiot and absolutely stupid. So what is it there? You go there and they throw a little water on you, and your life is saved. You get the protection letter, and you are all right after that. I said, no, I'm not going. So, okay. Next morning, this friend of mine comes to my bed and throws something at me. He said, what is this? I said, well, you stupid idiot, this is your letter of protection. How? I didn't go. I didn't baptize. You didn't. I know that. I didn't. But I did, he said. When they called, when we got there, at the chapel, they called the names. And when my name was called, I went there and got baptized. And then they called your name. I got baptized again.
So good. Who was this guy?
Well, he's dead. Whenever I am in Hungary, I go to his grave, and I never forgot him.
Where was he from?
He's in the outskirts of Budapest. Mm-hmm. It's a simple guy, but extremely nice.
It sounds like, yeah, it. What was his name?
Zoltán Bihari. Mm-hmm. That's also a Hungarian house name. Originally it was called Blumberger. Mm-hmm. Blumberger, and that was turned into Bihari. Anyway, that's just it. To give you a feel how things were in those days. So, okay, that was in the summer of 1944, mm-hmm, and in November of the same year, they surrounded us, the Hungarian gendarmerie, essentially, and the Arrow Cross Party, which is the same as the Germans, and they deported us first to the west of Hungary, to the border of Germany. Austria in those days was part of Germany, and then ultimately to Mauthausen.
Yeah. So the whole camp?
The whole camp. Everyone.
So the protection letter had no effect?
It's a good thing you asked. At the border, the gendarmerie took everything out, everything from us, every little thing. And when this guy, the gendarme, saw the letter of protection, he laughed. He said, "You can have this. It won't help you." And he was right. So, and that's how we ended up in Mauthausen.
So you were there with the whole labor service unit with which you had been serving?
Yes, well, essentially. One or two guys were lucky that the guys somehow escaped this way, that way, but essentially, yes.
Mm-hmm. And this was in November?
In fact, this guy,
the Zoltan
escaped. He was very, very. Somehow he was able to talk to one of the guys who was helping out the Germans and the gendarme there, or a worker there, who had a carriage. A horse-drawn carriage, and to my utter amazement, I can see him sitting together with this guy, talking to him, and in the process of talking, they were going out of this whole surrounded area, and they were left out.
They just walked out.
The whole time he left out, yeah.
Did you see him later, or did he explain?
Yes. He even came to New York much later. Yeah. I mean, for a while, but then he went back, and he died many years ago. Yeah.
So you were in Mauthausen then, and this was starting in. You said you were there starting in which month?
When
did you arrive to Mauthausen?
I arrived in April. No, end of March. End of March of 1945. Oh. Most of the war was already over by then. Budapest was occupied, or I mean retaken,
right.
Taken by the Russians, etc. But I was on my way to the death camp.
So how long were you in Mauthausen?
Mauthausen? Not too long. Only to the end of the war. I was liberated by the American army on the 5th of June of the same year.
And what were those, so it was about
March? Not more than 3 months.
So could you talk a bit about those 3 months?
Rather than talking, I wrote about it.
Oh, did you?
Yes. I wrote about it, and I'm going to give you a copy of that. That will be, yeah. But that will.
Well, we can do it later.
More eloquently than I can do.
Oh, yeah, and you can do it later. We can do that. Well, maybe we can finish.
Okay. So, that's it.
And then you were liberated by the Americans. And what was that like? Were you expecting it? Did people know what was happening?
Well, all kinds of rumors, but, you know, you could never tell which is founded, unfounded, whatever. But as you will read it, which is probably the most memorable moment in my life, and probably a moment that very few alive or even dead can tell that they witnessed it. The moment of liberation. I think that's unique in its kind. I was able to, from that barrack where I was essentially half dead, through a little window, seeing the act of liberation and how it happened.
How did it happen? How did it happen?
Let me read it to you.
Romay reads from a memoir fragment entitled De Profundis, Memoir of an Inmate at Mauthausen Concentration Camp, March to May 1945, which was published in the Austrian History Yearbook in 1996.
I can never tell you exactly the way it was. So I am in that barrack now, all naked as we were kept there for weeks and weeks. And every day one of us was dead. Now, we couldn't tell one day from the next. I believe about 3 weeks went by. We were fewer and fewer. New supply of prisoners was ebbing. Most bunks had three and sometimes only two. We started out with four. Four were put in a bunk that normally is for one. There was no human contact. We no longer cared about the others, not even about our own fate. I became lethargic and stared heedlessly into the space, just like the prisoners I saw upon arrival. It was early afternoon, and lying on the topmost bunk, I saw through a tiny window on the top of the hill grim buildings of the camp administration surrounding the Appelplatz, that's the German name, the square where prisoners were counted before going to work. For days now there was only deep silence there, no more labor troops. The Appelplatz seemed totally deserted. It was a huge, huge Appelplatz. Suddenly, on the winding road, a jeep appeared, followed by an armored car with a soldier and a machine gun mounted on it. They moved very, very slowly, cautiously uphill. The buildings on top were separated by a steel barrier from the rest of the camp. Today it was not the usual SS guard. The soldiers wore a different uniform. The two strange-looking vehicles reached the barrier. They stopped, and for a while the two sides eyed each other. Then the German guard raised the barrier without any resistance. Just as slowly as they came, the vanguard moved forward and stopped again in the middle of the square. Two giant-looking American soldiers got out. A minute later, the eerie silence was shattered by an earthquake-like rumble. Human-like shapes, clad in striped prison pajamas, crawled forth from nowhere, moving grotesquely, seemingly senseless, stumbling, falling and getting up again, trying to approach the Americans. All the while, they were shouting and screaming inarticulately. The sounds emitted were hardly human. They threw themselves at the Americans, who stood there in shock and disbelief, taking in this apocalyptic scene. Tripping over each other, they kissed their hands, their feet, their uniforms, wherever they could touch them. Many crawled around the vehicles convulsively in hysterics. If man ever cried out from the depths, here was the nadir. These were the victims of the great German Empire. All the enslaved, humiliated, downtrodden people of Europe. This moment remains indelibly set in your memory. Very few lived through such a scene and survived to bear witness. This is an experience during which you know, right when it happens, that the rest of your life cannot produce nothing like it. And perhaps time ought to come to a stop here. For a brief moment it seemed that justice prevailed after all. The innocent is set free and the evil is punished. Yeah. So, now this is the, very short as you can see. It was published by the University of Minnesota. Mm-hmm. They have a program called the Austrian Studies, and this is part of a bigger book, the Austrian History Yearbook.
Excellent. Yeah. Is it all right if I post it together with the interview? Is it all right if I post it together with the interview?
Yes.
Excellent.
Yes.
It's really wonderful. So could you talk a bit about what it was like? So did the camp become a DP camp after that?
No. I really don't know what it has become, because I was put in an American makeshift tent hospital.
In the same place?
In the same place where they tried to bring me back to normal life, but it was not that easy job, because I couldn't swallow anymore. Because the juices that help the digestion, they disappeared, because we didn't eat anything.
Right, yeah.
So we couldn't swallow anymore.
So what did they give you?
Only pouring down some fluid.
I
couldn't chew or anything like that, no. So I was in that hospital, and unfortunately most of the people died there, almost all of them, very young people.
Oh my God.
And then after all, they said there was nothing more they can do, because they were not prepared to face such a thing.
Mm-hmm.
That's not part of the war effort. They could handle someone wounded, this and that,
mm-hmm.
but nothing like young people unable to swallow.
So did they give you like sugar water, or how did they?
Well, all kinds of fluids. I don't know exactly what, probably vitamin in it. I don't know exactly what happened. That's all I could take. Yeah, I was quite popular, because most of the liberated people couldn't speak English, but I was able to, not very well, but somehow was able to translate between the Americans and the sick people they treated.
Were most of them Hungarian?
No, not really. We didn't know each other. This became, how shall I say, a world before any civilization started. So we didn't know each other, we didn't care for each other. It was just a number. So we really, really couldn't. I mean, if there was a Hungarian there, I would probably be able to tell. But I cannot recall in that barrack where I was liberated to have seen any Hungarian.
What language did you speak with them, the other camp? Hmm? What language did you speak with the other camp inmates? With the other inmates?
That was.
But if you translated to the Americans, how did you?
Broken German. Uh-huh. Broken German, because that was to a very limited extent they could all somehow understand. But you know, the conversation was so primitive. So, you know, just the daily things, move this food and this, but it's very primitive. So the whole thing was like before civilization started, probably several thousand years ago. We didn't know each other. In other words, I really don't know who the other were.
So what?
For all kinds. There were all kinds. It was not only Hungarians. All kinds. You know, there was a Frenchman. I recall that, but I don't know the others. I don't know.
So how long did it take you to recover?
I was there for a month, and then they put me on a train. And I was taken back home, back to Budapest. And to my utter surprise, I found my family.
What had your family been doing during this time period? What had they, like your brother, your parents?
Nothing. They were just. It was miserable because they were in the ghetto, you know. And I don't know, they were in one little room. I don't know what could they eat at all. But somehow they managed. They were not taken away. They were not shot, because many of them were shot and thrown in the Danube. But not my parents. So they survived. And my brother.
What was your brother?
My brother survived in Miskolc, where we lived before. He was in the Fort Weber camp and somehow ended up in the hospital. I don't know whether it was something real or unreal, but ended up in the hospital and to his luck, the Russians, because that's to the east, they liberated Miskolc at least 3 months before Budapest. Mm-hmm. It's very, very few Jewish family survived the war so well as we did, because I mean the immediate family, because I lost many uncles and many aunts and cousins and this and that, but they were all in the countryside.
So did your parents know what had happened to you? Or did they know that you were still alive?
I'll tell you one thing. When I finally got there and rang the bell, my brother, he didn't open. There was the window, the door was such that there was first you could open a little window, before you opened the door. So she opened the door, and then I said, Servus, Karsheta. He just looked at me and bewildered, and he didn't recognize me.
Really?
He did not recognize me.
He must have been quite thin.
Well, we all had a body of an infant and the head of an old guy. The head showed all the misery, all the misery like an old guy, and the body was little, nothing, like an infant. So, and also I was wearing the striped pyjamas. Well, actually, the first time, as I told you, before the liberation, we were naked for many weeks. But in the hospital, I got the striped pyjama. And that was the only thing that I had on when I showed up in Budapest, and my brother wouldn't recognize me and went back to tell my mother, here is someone who says who is Bandi, my nickname is Bandi. And of course my mother came and she had no problem to recognize me.
So did she think that you hadn't survived?
Yes, is it?
She didn't know you were alive before then.
Sorry,
she didn't know that you were alive before then.
No.
So what was it like? I mean, being in Budapest again,
for many months I was bedridden, of course. And I only got out of bed when all my friends from that intermediate stop at the Austrian border, who were all killed after I left, you will read it in this here. They were buried at the mass burial was in Budapest. And that was the first time I got out of bed to go to the cemetery. That was quite a few months later.
Were you physically? I mean,
physically.
Was it just that you were physically weak, or were you also depressed?
No, I was not depressed, but physically certainly I was I could hardly move. I could move, but. With an effort. Depressed, yes. Yeah, you know, you in your mind you play it back, the whole thing. It back and back and back, and each time you say I should have done this, I should have done that. And you blame yourself that you didn't do that. Like somehow escaping. So, yeah, that's... But that was long ago, so...
Did you think what you were going to do next? Did you...
No, not really. For me to be... home with my parents, that was all I wanted, and didn't want anything else. That's it. To give my life back.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Because obviously in my mind I already buried them.
Well.
Because everyone said that Budapest was destroyed and that no one is alive and this and that.
Really?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. So I did go back because there was nowhere else to go, but I felt that my chances to see them alive were next to nothing. Yeah. And I was really utterly surprised to see that Budapest was standing, still there.
So were they in the same...
I saw this girl on my way to my parents.
Who is she?
She's a girlfriend of mine from those days. That's me.
Is this?
You may not recognize me, but that's me.
And when was this taken?
That was taken in 1940.
Oh, okay. So when you just started the university.
Uh-huh. So and that girl is still alive and lives in Palm Beach.
Really? Oh, God.
Well, of course, she's 87 now.
So when you got back together with your parents, had their situation changed? I mean, were they living in the same place as they had been?
No, there was another surprise. I went back to our old apartment, and there they were. They went from the ghetto after the liberation, after the Russians took back Budapest, mm-hmm. They went back to their house.
Mm-hmm. So, can you talk a bit about this period, you know, after the liberation? What was your experience or your family's experience with the Russians, for example?
That's secondhand. I had absolutely nothing to do with Russians. I cannot recall any confrontation or anything with Russians, but I heard, of course, many observations and stories that were not very friendly or
So by the time they got there, were most of them not there anymore, or
they were? Yeah, you could see them. They were there. Maybe not all the troops, but you could see them occasionally in the street there and there. But they were there.
Did people have a sense of where things? I mean, where
but
things?
But people
were...
say that the Russians didn't make any difference. That if they then after they took Budapest. And they wanted people for a little rabotni. They took Jews just as well as the non-Jews, so for them it made no difference.
So did people have a sense of like what was... I mean, how did your parents talk about the politics of that time and about their own future? Did your father keep doing what he was doing?
No. He gave it up. He gave up before the Germans came in.
Oh, so
No. They were at the time. My father was already around 84. Mm-hmm. No, in high, yeah. High 60s, close to 70, so he was retiring.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I mean, that sort of a well-to-do life that we had before, of course, wasn't there anymore, although he still owned the building and this and that, so you cannot say that he was a poor guy. But the general conditions were very poor.
Mm-hmm.
So, you live there from one day to another saying that, oh, tomorrow we'll be able to buy a little butter or this and that. That was the food was the main concern, mm-hmm. to find the food. And there was... So, now, the general conditions were really miserable. But
what about people?
For me, that was paradise. Okay, I think that for the time being, that should do.